Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, partly cloudy skies expected, maybe reaching a high of 62. And then for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows around 40. Should be partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 62. Currently, relative humidity is at 25%. Relatively chilly in the valley under partly cloudy skies. It's 59 degrees.
Governor Doug Ducey will be a part of bilateral government and business meetings that are taking place in the capital of Sonora today and tomorrow. He'll be in the company not only of his Sonoran counterpart, Governor Claudia Pavlovich, but also of Mexican cabinet members and top business executives. While there are many questions about the future of U.S. trade and homeland security with our neighbor to the south, local and state officials like Governor Ducey are conducting diplomacy at the local level. Here with more about it is Jorge Valencia with our KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau. And Jorge, what are these meetings and what's happening there?
So officially, this is the summit for the Arizona-Sonora and the Arizona-Mexico Commission, which are organizations that are made up, like you just mentioned, of government and business leaders. So we've got the governors, we've got people from the federal level, the Mexican federal level. And maybe more interestingly, we have business leaders. Let's say, for example, on the agenda, there's a speech from Gabriel Lopez. He's the CEO of Ford Mexico, which has been in the news recently. And the reason why this is interesting is because the result of what happens in these types of meetings, what happens in the hallways, what happens in restaurants and in private meetings is what governors like Doug Ducey and governors everywhere love to talk about, which is jobs.
Now, obviously, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been in the headlines recently, especially given President-elect Donald Trump's views on trade. Do you expect that to be part of the agenda?
It is not part of the agenda. And obviously, the question is, why not? I mean, this is something that is going to impact the work that all these people who are here are doing. So I presented this question to the executive director of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. His name is Marcos Garay, and here's what he had to say.
We have a very small piece of real estate in the world, relatively speaking, but we want to make this the best. So, you know, what happens with NAFTA at this point is pure speculation.
So as you can see, this is something that probably people are talking about privately, but at least the people who are in charge of the conference want to keep it out of the official conversation, if you will.
Jorge, how important are these meetings for Governor Ducey?
Well, this matters a lot because he has been trying to cultivate relationships in Sonora in Mexico, especially during his administration, to sort of turn the ship, if you will, go in a different direction that his predecessor went in. And somebody who's been in this environment for a long time of these cross-border relations is a guy named Eric Lee. He's executive director of the North American Research Partnership. He's here, and here's how he explained the importance of it.
It's a key meeting for Governor Doug Ducey. He's got what looks like very little support from the president-elect for an active trade agenda with Mexico. At least it looks that way right now in early December. We'll see how this looks in mid-February, early March.
So if you're driving on your way to work in, let's say, Pinal County, what happens here is something that could make a difference in your community. I mean, just to take an example, there was that deal that Lucid Motors announced this week in Casa Grande, and they say that they're going to hire about 2,000 people in that community, and that largely it's because of the proximity to their supply chain across the border in Sonora. So these relationships make a difference in our communities.
That's KJZZ's Jorge Valencia in our Mexico City Bureau. Jorge, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The Valley's relationship with real estate has been up and down, featuring some of the best and worst runs of any market in the country. Over the past couple of years, normalcy has set in, with prices gradually going up and foreclosures going down. And now the website Realtor.com is projecting that Phoenix will be the top housing market in the U.S. in 2017, based upon price gains and sales growth. And to figure out what that could really mean, I'm joined by Mark Stapp, Executive Director of the Master of Real Estate Development Program at ASU. Mark, does this make sense to you, and how probable is it that Phoenix is going to be the number one housing market?
It's possible. In fact, I don't think just possible. It's highly likely that Phoenix is top housing market next year. And I think we have all of the fundamentals which support the idea of us being a top housing market. You know, percentages are misleading because if you're starting with a low base, you can have a large percentage increase. I think we're going to continue to see some increases. And on a percentage basis, I think it's possible. But I think real numbers matter also. And it's going to continue to be tough for us to get back to where we were. And I don't really think we want to get back to exactly where we were. There really wasn't a sustainable marketplace.
If, in fact, this projects to be correct, that Phoenix is number one, is this something that the general populace should be excited about? I mean, is this a good sign for, this shows that the Phoenix economy is doing well, that job growth is good in addition to, because wouldn't all these factors have to come together? Or is it really just about, hey, if you're selling, this is a good time?
No, I think this is a good indication that we are a fairly stable marketplace right now. I think we are chunking along nicely. We don't have over exuberance. I think there's some factors in the market. Some of them are systemic, meaning they affect the entire United States and housing markets. And some of them are specific to us that are keeping a governor on the rate of actual growth that we have here. When you look at what our population growth is, and we're growing at about 1.8% Metro Phoenix area. So that's about 80-some thousand people a year that we're adding. There's some basic math. When you look at number of persons per household, you look at population growth, you can come to a number of housing units, and it's in that 20,000, 25,000 unit range, and that's multifamily and single family. You know, that's about what we're doing. I wouldn't say we're in complete equilibrium, but I think we're matching some of our supply with some of our demand.
This may be cynicism born from that period during the Great Recession when things were so poor, but is there anything dangerous? Are there any potential pitfalls related to being the number one market and heating up to a point where there does come that Alan Greenspan irrational exuberance phrase?
Is there a downside to being number one? A couple of things that happen. You know, people chase opportunities, capital chases yield, people look for places to go, and you get some of that moniker, and you get a lot of people that run there. And then that causes prices to be run up, it causes supply to be added that really shouldn't be added. You run that risk. I don't see that happening here. I think even if we're considered the number one market, it's going to be because we got some fundamentals that are working. And as long as we stay away from the things that created the problem to begin with, you totally deregulate lending. You start lending like you did before. Lots of easy money. People go crazy. But I don't know if that will happen or not. There's still some uncertainty. So you don't want to be cynical. There's still a lot of uncertainty in the market, and you look at the bond market and you look at the stock market and the reaction to the election and the uncertainty associated with how this new administration is going to deal with regulations. It can go really wonky, but yeah. I just don't see that actually happening. I mean, it's a low probability.
Mark Stapp is Executive Director of the Master of Real Estate Development Program at ASU. We've been talking about Realtor.com projecting Phoenix to have the top housing market in the U.S. in 2017.
Governor Doug Ducey and other state officials this week lauded the decision of California-based Lucid Motors to invest $700 million to build a manufacturing plant in Casa Grande. But the company admits it doesn't yet have the $700 million to invest. A spokesman says Lucid has a few hundred million from investors and will be going out for another round of funding. He says the $700 million total is through the year 2022. But state officials don't seem too worried about that. Here's gubernatorial spokesman Daniel Scarpinato.
The governor personally obviously toured the facility, met with them on multiple occasions. And so we always do due diligence with these issues.
Scarpinato points out Arizona had competition from other places for this facility, which shows it's a good get for the state. And Tim Knavel, program manager with Pinal County's Economic Development Department, says even though the deal calls for the county to buy the land, it still doesn't pose that much risk.
If for some reason this company, now between now and when they purchase the property, say we don't want it, well then, you know what, we own 493 acres of prime industrial real estate and it'll cost a grand. And, you know, we can always sell that. So we feel that the risk is very minimized on that.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services has been reporting on this and looking into the company a bit more. And Howie, Governor Ducey and others made a big deal about Lucid coming to Arizona. How are they responding to questions now about whether or not this company is financially viable?
Well, there's due diligence and due diligence. It depends on how you define it, sort of like what is. And at risk of being, you know, sounding a little smarmy, you know, they contend, look, we saw the company has an R&D facility in California. We saw that they have raised a couple of $100 million, and we are taking them at their word that they are going to be able to go ahead and raise the additional money in time to do this, that they don't need the full build out till 2022, that if they get a couple of $100 million more, they'll be able to do it. Now, of course, that also assumes that they're not spending it on R&D in California before that. So it's a question of faith. The other part of it is from the governor's perspective, you know, leaving aside the hoopla and the, you know, the little political capital he hopes to gain, is that the money that the company might get, at least from the state, is all contingent on creating the jobs. No jobs, no incentives. So there's really no loss, at least for the state taxpayers.
Governor Doug Ducey, as you obviously know, has spent a lot of time talking about trying to bring companies, specifically tech-based companies, to Arizona. And it seems like with those kinds of companies, this is referred to often as a startup, that there is some sort of inherent, as you called it earlier, faith that these are reasonably new companies, although this particular one is not maybe as new as its name would suggest. But is there just some risk and some faith that state officials have to put into these companies if this is in fact the type of business that they want to bring here?
Well, again, you know, it's sort of a nothing ventured, nothing gained. If in fact the companies you're going to attract are not necessarily the establishment companies. It's not like Apple is necessarily picking up, you know, they had that little Apple Glass facility that really ended up going nowhere. But in general, you may have to go after the new companies, the companies with a little more risk that, in fact, they won't be able to produce what they want. Now, we bid on other companies. You know, we bid against Nevada and a couple of other states for the Tesla Giga Battery Factory, and Nevada gave away, you know, something like $3 billion in incentives and property tax breaks and sales tax breaks. So we can decide what we want to bid on and what becomes too lucrative.
Do Governor Ducey and other state officials expect that having Lucid in Casa Grande will lead to more development in that area, more jobs coming to that area? Like, do they see this as a lure for other like-minded or supply-type businesses to be coming there?
Well, there's certainly going to need to be a supply chain. If you're building a car, you know, you're bringing in all sorts of parts. You know, they're not manufacturing bumpers there. They're not manufacturing catalytic converters there. But how much of that would actually be manufactured in Arizona remains to be seen. As we know, Governor Claudia Pavlovich of Sonora came up because she's got some suppliers who think that they're going to be able to provide some of the jobs and some of the parts for what will be needed to eventually put this car together, assuming it ever gets built there. You certainly will have certain development that will follow it, but this isn't like a cluster. For example, you know, Silicon Valley has a cluster in terms of some high-tech stuff because you have the employers there. You have the people who are trained there. There's a certain synergy. I don't know that if you suddenly put together an all-electric car plant in Casa Grande, even assuming they could turn out 130,000 cars a year, which is the goal, that suddenly Ford and GM and Chrysler are suddenly going to say, oh, we want to build cars here in Arizona too.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Well, I'm hoping for my own version of that $130,000 car.
For free, of course, right?
For free, of course.
Psychotic illnesses like schizophrenia can be debilitating, and they usually hit at a crucial period in life, the late teens and early 20s. But most people who experience psychosis don't get treatment for years after it begins, which can lead to homelessness, substance abuse, and neglect. As the show's Lauren Gilger reports, that's why two clinics are opening in Phoenix this year to treat psychosis early.
Gabriel Maturana was 12 when he had his first psychotic break.
There were times where I would wake up and I would feel like I was being choked.
He started hearing voices.
I would hear laughing and sometimes I would beat my head against the wall.
He became convinced that people could read his thoughts.
I kept thinking I was like I was losing myself.
Now at 18, he's been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and schizophrenia. And after years of treatment, he's taken what was once a burden and turned it into something positive. Gabriel is one of the young adults who serves on the Youth Leadership Council for Mercy Maricopa, the regional behavioral health authority in the Valley. It's made up of 14 to 26-year-olds who are living with mental illness and help the behavioral health provider tailor services for young people.
You're not the only one, you're in your community.
But he certainly felt like the only one when he went through that first episode.
It was very intense.
A lot of young people especially, the first time they experience an episode or symptoms of mental illness, they're scared.
Katie Galligan is the transition age youth coordinator for Mercy Maricopa. She advises the Youth Leadership Council.
They don't want to come forward talking about it. It might be years and years before they seek their first help. And by that time, you know, the illness has taken its toll on them. They may have been out of work. They may have been out of school.
But if they can get treatment early when psychosis first appears, usually in someone's late teens or early 20s, they have an all-important chance to change the direction of their lives, according to Dr. Nick Brightboard. He opened one of the first early psychosis intervention centers at the University of Arizona in Tucson in 2010 and now runs the Epicenter program at The Ohio State University.
The mission that we were trying to accomplish here is to really bend the curve in terms of what we expect for recovery for these young adults.
And recovery often isn't part of the conversation for many people who experience psychosis. Brightboard says schizophrenia is one of the most debilitating illnesses that can affect you, and the outcomes of treatment are not usually very good. But that's partly because most people with symptoms of psychosis go 2 years before they get any kind of treatment, and then they can miss their window of opportunity.
During those first few years, this is the period of time where people are most responsive to the treatments, whether it be medication or our therapies here.
Now, two new early psychosis intervention centers are opening in Phoenix to give young people a place to come for treatment when they first start experiencing symptoms of psychosis and help them on the road to recovery. The Institute for Mental Health Research and Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care opened a second epicenter in downtown Phoenix in October, and Maricopa Integrated Health Systems is opening a first episode clinic in West Phoenix this December.
That's really huge because in Maricopa County, we have a lot of young people in the behavioral health system, and we hadn't had a center like this.
In Maricopa County alone, there are about 450 young people each quarter who are transitioning out of the child behavioral health system and into the adult one, and that transition can be a challenge.
It's almost like some young people tell me they feel as if the bottom drops out when they turn 18.
Galligan says teenagers who age out of the system can easily get lost, and then they can fall away from treatment altogether.
It's a large change. It's super stressful. And if they don't have immensely positive experiences with either system, they're not going to stay.
When Gabriel Maturana first started going to clinics for mental health treatment, he says it was tough for him to open up.
It was very corporate. It was very professional. I never felt comfortable. I always felt intimidated by the environment.
So when it came to designing the new epicenter, the Youth Council was involved from the beginning to make sure this wasn't like any other clinic.
They looked at the decor. They looked at what they were going to have, the floors, the artwork, what color the walls were going to be, what the space looked like.
So the center is open, bright, and friendly, with a community room, outdoor space, and a colorful mural painted on the outside.
Those are the tiny nuanced things that we don't think about that could really make or break a young person continuing on with behavioral health services once they turn 18.
For Gabriel, the new center is a chance for him to make things better for other young people than they were for him.
When you start on the children's system, because of the bad experiences that you have, you focus so much on the negative that you want to be done with it at a certain point.
He says he often felt alone, and when he was 16, he attempted suicide for the first time. But as he got older, he decided to change his mindset.
Because that's the one thing in the behavioral system you can change. I mean, you can't change your mental illness or your environment or your culture, your family, but you can change your mindset and the way you look at things.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
Today is World AIDS Day. And this fall, Phoenix became the 11th American city to join the Fast Track Cities Initiative with the goal of reducing HIV and AIDS as public health threats. With me to talk about the importance of that partnership and how Phoenix and the other cities involved may reach their goals is Glenn Spencer. He's executive director of Aunt Rita's Foundation, a Phoenix-based group that's also working to eliminate HIV and AIDS. And Glenn, what to you is the significance of Phoenix joining this effort to essentially eradicate HIV/AIDS?
And that's exactly correct, Mark. I mean, the goal is to effectively eradicate HIV in our community. And we have the opportunity to do that now. So it's a big deal in terms of helping all of us in the community who have been diligently working on this issue for years and decades to have the partnership of the City of Phoenix and the city government to help coordinate and collaborate with us to do better.
Now, when you say effectively eradicate HIV and AIDS in our community, what exactly does that mean?
So the benchmarks that have been established are referred to as the 90-90-90-0 benchmarks, and that's the UN AIDS benchmarks. The first 90% is if we can identify 90% of persons who are HIV positive and test them, then that's the first goal. The second 90% is to get 90% of individuals who are HIV positive, who have already tested, into treatment and on HIV medications, which we know are very effective now and extremely capable of suppressing the viral suppression or viral replication. Right now, we're only at about 60% in the city of Phoenix and about 50% in the state of Arizona on that second 90. So therein lies the great opportunity to get people into treatment. And we know that once people are in treatment, and especially when they are virally suppressed, meaning that their HIV is undetectable in their bloodstream, they are not infectious to others. So if we can eliminate the infectiousness of people who are HIV positive, that's the way to effectively eradicate the spread of HIV.
How does this goal sort of resonate with stories that we hear in the news about outbreaks of HIV in places like Indiana and elsewhere, where communities are seeing an uptick in this virus?
It is so true. And because AIDS is not the disease that it was in the 80s and the 90s, the problem that we're seeing now in communities is one of complacency. Our new HIV numbers are on the rise in Arizona. And it's because of that complacency.
Well, if people who may be positive aren't tested, is it even possible to know how close we are to meeting these benchmarks?
We have very good algorithms and statistical analyses that have been developed over the course of time with the HIV epidemic that we can relatively effectively predict what percentage of individuals are positive that have not been tested. If, on the other hand, we were able to successfully implement routine HIV testing at outpatient facilities, at emergency rooms, where everybody is being regularly tested, then that statistic now becomes very, very accurate. We don't have to use the predictive models that we're using right now.
Is it a realistic goal to say that you are going to basically entirely eradicate HIV? I mean, is the best case scenario that people who are positive know it and are getting treatment for it, and the spread maybe declines a little bit? I mean, is it realistic just to get rid of it?
Well, at this moment, the best we can say is to effectively get rid of it and, as you say, kind of stop the spread of HIV.
What does it mean for a group like yours that the city itself is getting behind this effort now?
Mark, I was present at the city council chambers when this was voted on, and I can tell you that it was a teary moment. I myself am living with HIV. I tested positive in 2002, and since 2005, really since 2004, have been diligently working in this arena to help others because I was helped so much by other organizations in this area. And I'm so happy that I'm now healthy again and back at work, and I'm just as healthy as the next person. But it was touching from a personal standpoint, and it's inspiring from a community standpoint that we can strive to do better and strive to not accept mediocrity as our goal and instead set a benchmark to achieve in this healthcare arena.
Glenn Spencer is the executive director of Aunt Rita's Foundation. Glenn, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
In his last days in office, President Obama still has the power to make significant changes to the Southwest. The president has already used the Antiquities Act to designate 23 national monuments, more than any other president. Many American Indian tribes are hoping he takes action on at least one more proposal. From the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laura Morales reports.
Some of the geological formations in the Southwest look like something out of a Dr. Seuss book, and Bears Ears is one of those places. It's a pair of buttes, or steep hills, that emerge from the ground in southern Utah. They're covered on one side by a ponderosa pine forest, and the other by scrubby pinyon juniper trees.
It's a very sacred place. Leave it the way it is.
Navajo elder Jonah Yellowman holds the branch of a juniper tree as if he's shaking hands with it.
We talk to these trees. When the breeze comes through, they talk to us. Sometimes when you're out there, when you're by yourself, you can feel something over here. You can hear something. Sometimes you look over there.
At the end of a windy, unmarked trail, Yellowman picks up a piece of Anasazi pottery laying on the ground.
Oh, wow.
So as you walk around, you find something everywhere.
Bears Ears is rich with such artifacts. Leaders from several tribes have asked President Obama to protect them from looting, mining, and off-trail vehicles. They'd like Obama to set aside 1.9 million acres as monument land. Zuni farmer and museum director Jim Enote says Bears Ears contains a library of knowledge.
Bears Ears helps us to connect the dots of our history and our ancestors' experiences. And those places, those homes or those shrines and altars, when they were built, they were consecrated. And once they were consecrated for life.
On one of his visits to Bears Ears, Enoch came across an old village where he made offerings, much like people would at a cemetery with flowers. Then he noticed someone had carved into the petroglyphs and dug into a dwelling wall.
How could anybody do something like that? We wouldn't do that at a cemetery. Of course not. If people are able to respect places like cemeteries or war memorials or war battlefields, places that are sacred to many people, why can't they afford us the same kind of respect and civility?
It is a sacred place. It's sacred to all of us.
Angela Hurst can see Bears Ears from her yard in Blanding.
That's it, right there. We see it every day. It's part of our home.
Hurst and many of her neighbors don't want a monument. Blanding is already surrounded by federal land. Hurst grew up in Blanding, picnicking at Bears Ears almost every weekend.
I'm afraid that making a monument takes it away from us, makes it so much less accessible to the regular people.
Under the monument proposal, people would still be able to picnic, collect firewood, hunt, and graze their animals with permits. But San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman says he and other local leaders should be the ones to manage it, not the federal government.
I've never tried to exceed my defined authority, and I wish the federal government could say the same thing, because they are constantly pushing the bounds of their jurisdiction, their authority, their legal reach.
Lyman could get his wish next month if the Republican-controlled Congress has their way. University of California Hastings Professor Emeritus John Leshy says many have tried to gut the Antiquities Act.
The Republican Party has tried to change the law, to repeal it, to exempt their states from it, do all sorts of things. There have been countless proposals to do that over the last 25 years. They've never made it out of the Congress. But now we have a whole different landscape.
Utah Republican congressional leaders have proposed smaller protections for the land. They say putting Bears Ears on the map as a monument would draw the same problems tribal leaders are trying to prevent. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Anara Martinez, and we're going to volunteer and pack some bags. We do this every Thursday.
My name's Lolati Taylor, and the school that we pack for, some of these children don't have enough food to get through the week, the weekend.
Three, four.
One potato, two potato, three potato, four.
Milk, juice,
cuties. Gotta do soup.
And we pack bags for 70 children.
It goes really fast because when you just get a bag, it just people just keep on going and going.
I do it so that I can teach her to be thankful.
And so I thank the earth for giving me the things I need, the sun and the rain and the apple seed.
That's Inara Martinez and her mom, Lolati Taylor, packing lunches for children in need. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
In a check of international news on KJZZ, first it was Brexit in the spring when a majority of UK voters unexpectedly voted to leave the European Union, then the election of Donald Trump, both events that confounded pollsters.
Are these isolated political events or part of a wider change in the world's developed democracies? That's a question being asked in Europe, where elections will take place in the Netherlands, Germany, and France next year. The BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones has this report from London.
Here in Britain, the vote to leave the EU, or the so-called Brexit, back in May was nothing short of a political earthquake.
Dare to dream that the dawn is breaking on an independent, united kingdom.
Yeah! A jubilant Nigel Farage, the face of Brexit. That was a big surprise to many, as of course was the US election result, but these may not be the only ones. Jan Tekau is from the American Academy in Berlin. He's watching populist parties gearing up for March's general election in the Netherlands.
It's a traditionally outward-looking country, a seafaring country, a liberal, open-minded country. And all of a sudden, a very charismatic populist leader emerged.
And that leader is Geert Wilders, well known for his views on anti-immigration, a politician openly critical of the culture and ideology of Islam.
I have a problem with the Islamic ideology, the Islamic culture. Because I believe that the more Islam we get in our free societies, the less freedom we will get.
Well, Geert Wilders' party is expected to double its seats in that election, and that will be a highly symbolic success if it happens. The Germans also go to the polls next year in September, and for the first time in post-war Germany, what's described as a credible and electable party has emerged on the right. It's called the AfD, or Alternative for Germany, a mix of nationalism, xenophobia and anti-globalization sentiments. Experts say it could change Germany's power balance. Jan Tekau again.
It really has an international message, and that message is the old elites are corrupt. They're not really interested in us, and we need to get these people out.
The AfD, he says, will win seats in Parliament. The question is how many? A significant bloc, some expect, expressing Trump-like resentment. And its support won't just come from the poor and dispossessed, he says.
You have a fairly well-off middle class that now starts to be attracted by this, not necessarily because they can't pay the bills any longer, but because they have something to lose. When these people look at the balance sheet and look at, you know, is there going to be a better future for my children than there was for me, often their answer is no.
Similar themes can be detected in France, which faces a presidential race in the spring. François Fillon, an admirer of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, will lead the centre-right. And for the far-right, the French National Front, it's Marine Le Pen.
Nous n'avons peut-être pas réussi à convaincre totalement les Français que nous étions capables de gouverner.
Le Pen's manifesto sounds, in part, similar to Donald Trump's on the campaign trail. French journalist Catherine Gilliardi.
The FN is actually a party that is economically presenting a program that is very close to Trump against wild, as she calls it, wild globalization. She wants to actually have pacified relationship with Russia. She doesn't want France to intervene in international conflict.
And of course, that other big issue, immigration. Marine Le Pen's key promise is to limit immigration. Heather Connolly is watching Europe from her desk at the CSIS think tank in Washington. She says immigration and globalization are among two of the common factors in these elections. And they're fueling, she says, the split between those riding these cultural changes and those resisting them.
They quite frankly don't even understand one another. And that's really what's, I think, creating this rejection of the elite in pretty much all advanced democracies.
The experts suggest far-right parties will fall short of victory in Europe's advanced democracies next year. But as recent history reminds us, the experts aren't always right.
That's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones.
In August, the Department of Justice put out a memo directing the Federal Bureau of Prisons to decline to renew the contracts for private prison operators. That directive affected just 13 facilities, housing more than 22,000 inmates. But the announcement was seen as a clear policy directive and seemed to indicate a shift by the federal government away from private prisons. Yesterday, the DOJ held a forum at the White House to talk new reforms to the federal prison system. Here's Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
As you know, there's a bridge from prison back home. Typically, they're called halfway houses. We've done a study of the ones that are affiliated with the Bureau of Prisons to see how are they carrying out the mandate to be the bridge from the institution itself back into the community. And while some of them are working very hard and are in fact doing a good job, it has not been up to what we want. And we are now, as of today, setting forth new standards that all of the halfway houses have to meet.
The DOJ released a memo yesterday outlining those standards, and I'm joined by KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins to talk about them. Jimmy, what are the new directives about?
As you heard Secretary Lynch say, they're focusing on halfway houses, the places offenders sometimes go to finish the end of their sentences. But the whole federal system, Steve, is privatized. The government depends on for-profits and nonprofits to manage their operations.
Well, then what kind of oversight does the government have?
That's what this new memo seeks to bolster. It was a list of 10 steps for the Bureau of Prisons to follow when they're renewing contracts with these groups. They include things like establishing uniform standards, providing stronger oversight of contracts, and creating performance metrics for factors like recidivism and hireability upon reentry. Emily Verdugo is a program coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee in Arizona. They advocate for criminal justice reform. Verdugo says this wasn't as far-reaching a reform as they would have liked, but the federal government is moving in the right direction.
They're actually asking for accountability, which is a huge step. Of course, we would prefer it to be government-owned, government-run, but you know, this is a good step.
So, Jimmy, how many people could be affected by this?
The government says it has contracts with more than 100 contractors operating 181 facilities that deal with 30,000 residents each year. There are at least three groups running seven halfway houses with these contracts in Arizona. One of them is a private company called New Beginnings Treatment Center. They run two halfway houses in Tucson. I spoke with their CEO, Pamela Henley Johnson, and she said they take issue with the way the DOJ came up with these directives. She thinks it wasn't an extensive enough process, and the findings don't accurately represent all reentry providers.
Nevertheless, though, the Bureau of Prisons will still implement these changes for now, but these actions are carried out by the executive branch. And as you know, we've got a new chief executive coming in January. How could that affect things?
Well, Deputy Attorney General Yates says she talked with the Trump transition team, and she believes they will leave these reforms in place. However, Jeff Sessions, the incoming attorney general, he's been critical of past attempts at criminal justice reform and could just as easily scrap these measures if he sees fit. But one thing I think is important to note is that Trump has spoken favorably about private prisons, and these new guidelines are actually an embrace of the continuation of that same kind of public-private partnership. DOJ is not as they were with the prisons, saying private contracts are ending. They are, in fact, saying, you know, we depend on private operators to run these facilities. We just want more oversight and more say in how they're managed.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
The view of Earth from space has long taken travelers' breath away, but it's rare that they admit how their perspective has been dramatically affected by that experience. Ron Guerin is totally open about that, even saying that space changed him. Guerin is a former NASA astronaut who had two missions to the International Space Station and spent more than 177 days in orbit. Guerin is currently working with Tucson-based Worldview on a way to get civilians closer to space. Ron, what did it feel like physically and emotionally to travel to the International Space Station?
Well, I think it's a very surreal experience, and I think it's surreal because we tend to have experiences that we've never experienced before. You know, when you're experiencing someone for the first time and you have no context to compare it to, then it becomes very surreal. And so just to give you an example, when we launched into space, you know, I had, you know, I was a jet fighter pilot, you know, for 15 years or more, you know, almost 20 years by that point. And so I had experienced acceleration. I experienced going straight up in aircraft, certainly. But what I never experienced was acceleration that lasted that long, and it was that forceful. Something clicked inside me that basically said, you are going really, really fast right now. And, you know, if you talk about spacewalks, you know, spacewalks are very surreal. because, again, there's no context that in my experience base to compare it to. But in all those cases, as you become more experienced and you get to do these things and you do start to develop a context to compare it to, then I think that it become more, routine is not the right word, but less surreal and more real. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
And when did you first start to notice that the way you were seeing things was a little bit different? And I don't know that you saw it this way, but some people might say, well, I sort of realize what a blip I am in the big picture of this entire planet and beyond this planet. When did it start to change for you? And would you say it's been a positive change?
Well, I don't think I've had that experience where I feel small or I feel humanity small. I think I've had somewhat of an opposite experience where everything seems more precious. The planet seems more precious. Our society and civilization seems more precious. I call it an epiphany in slow motion. I didn't look out the window for the first time and hear a choir of angels and see this beautiful sight. And immediately I think I was transformed. But, I got to spend months in space. I spent half of a year in space. And, over that time frame, and certainly in the time since flying in space, and I've had time to process the experience, I think I have had a very, very profound shift in my perspective. I think a realization, a little bit more accurate realization of the true reality of the world that we live in.
I wonder if you could relate to us. It was part of one of your onstage talks. You landed on the ground, you were in Kazakhstan, but it felt like you were home and you viewed home in a different way. Could you give us a version of that?
Yeah, when it was time to return to Earth after our six-month mission, my two Russian crewmates and I, which is another story, here I am, a military officer, a former, retired military officer flying with two Russian military officers, and I spent the first 15 years of my adult life training to fight those guys, and here I am, a fully integrated member of a Russian spacecraft crew, and we undock from the space station, we do a couple of laps around the planet, and as we cross the south tip of South America, we fishtailed our spacecraft around to point the engines backwards, and we fire the engines just enough to enter the atmosphere. We had this fiery, violent ride through the atmosphere at 5 miles a second. Our parachutes opened and it threw us all over the place. And then eventually we smashed into the ground. And when we smashed into the ground, we bounced, we rolled, we flipped over. And now my window was pointed down at the ground. And out of my window, I saw a rock, a flower, and a blade of grass. And I remember thinking to myself distinctly that I'm home. And what was really cool about that, what you mentioned, is I was home, but I was in Kazakhstan. And I realized this right away, and I kind of chuckled to myself thinking, my definition of the word home has been broadened. And I think our definition of that word home is so important because it has profound implications for how we problem solve, how we treat each other, how we treat our planet.
If everyone could travel to space somehow, would you encourage folks to do that, to maybe experience what you experienced?
Yeah, I think the more people that have the opportunity to see our planet from that perspective, the better off all of us here on the planet are going to be. That's why I'm the chief pilot of Worldview. That's why Worldview is called Worldview. It's written into the DNA of the company that we believe that people will have a transformative experience by seeing the Earth from that perspective.
Ron Guerin is a former NASA astronaut who's now the chief pilot for Tucson-based Worldview, which is working to help civilian passengers travel 20 miles above the Earth. And now it's time for the quiz show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ West Valley reporter, Casey Kuhn.
So last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two entries. The puzzle was, I'm tall when I'm young and I'm short when I'm old. What am I? The answer is a candle. Our randomly selected winners this week are Alicia Martinez and Stephanie Bean. Leszek will play on behalf of Alicia. Casey will play on behalf of Stephanie. Whoever wins gets a special KJZZ item.
You guys ready?
I guess.
Is somebody ready to kick some ass?
Well, I just want to preface this by saying I was on the quiz team. I have two letters from it in high school.
Wow.
We did not make it to state.
This is a ringer.
I mean, right. Objectively, it's totally a ringer. Like, because Casey almost made it to state on her quiz team, and then you've won several Tournament of Champions on Jeopardy. So yeah, we're just...
Very equal match here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Leszek, Thanksgiving was last week, and many of us ate large quantities of turkey. But the old-fashioned method of roasting it in the oven may not be the most efficient way to cook it. According to the Washington Post, the laws of physics say there must be a better way. What is that way? Is it deep frying, spatchcocking, or is it flash basting?
I read the website Serious Eats all the time, and they say that spatchcocking is the best way to do it.
Of course you read that website. What website don't you read? That is correct. Yeah, it's kind of like butterflying the turkey so that it doesn't take so long to cook all the way through. All right, Casey, there is a collaborative art project called Adrift that tracks 27,000 pieces of space junk, which are the debris that are left floating around space. What does the project do as it tracks this space junk? Does it turn them into music as they pass overhead? Do they use a high-powered vacuum designed by NASA to create an artificial black hole to suck up the space junk, thereby reducing space pollution? Or do they attach cameras to as many pieces of the space junk as possible in order to create a video installation about what you can see from space?
All of those do sound amazing. I'm going to go with music. I think that would be the easiest to do.
You are correct. Casey is peacocking a little bit here.
Feeling a little good, I can't lie.
All right, not to be confused with spatchcocking.
Exactly.
All right, Leszek, on a previous episode of The Quiz Show, I asked about a hair trend called the oil slick, where a person's hair is dyed to mimic the shiny, colorful look of an oil slick on the road. Because this is 2016, there's already a new hair trend called Phoenix hair. What is it? Is it hair that is teased really high in the front and sticks out in the back to mimic a phoenix rising? Is it hair that is singed at the bottom to create an ashy-like appearance? Or is it hair that is dyed like an orange-red rainbow and glows under a black light?
They all sound possible, but I'll guess, and this is just a guess, the first one.
No. It's actually hair that is dyed like an orange-red rainbow and glows under a black light. All right, Casey. The MTV show True Life profiles young people with unusual circumstances or ways of living their lives. Which of the following is not an episode of True Life this season? Is it called I'm in a Fight Church, which is about devout Christians who see praising God and pounding MMA opponents as intertwined? Is it I'm Starting a Religion, about people who are starting their own faiths, including one based on unicorn worship? Or is it I Live in a Dumpster, about people who choose to make their homes in garbage piles as a statement against consumerism?
Well, I have heard the first rule about Fight Church is you don't talk about Fight Church. So if this is one that's not on this season, and this is also a guess because as much as I love reality TV, I have not seen any True Lives. I'm going to go with Fight Church.
That is actually a real episode. The correct answer is I Live in a Dumpster. That's the one that's not real. All right, Leszek, there is a genre of music that is inspired by the Harry Potter books. What is it called? Is it called Rock That Should Not Be Named? Is it called Wizard Rock? Or is it called Quidditch Core?
Once again, a guess, Quidditch Core.
That is incorrect. It is actually
Wizard Rock. Yeah. That was my second guess.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I knew
Casey
that
Casey looked like she...
I've read them many times over.
All right, Casey, if you get this, you will have defeated Quizmaster Leszek. Okay, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. A study published in the journal Nature Human Behavior says that a team of neuroscientists has found a way to recondition the human brain to do what? Is it to overcome specific fears? To no longer have a panic response? Or to only have good dreams and not nightmares? Casey is writing furiously during every question I ask. She's got a notepad, like she came prepared, armed, ready to go.
Okay, let's see, recondition the brain. I'm going to say to no longer have a panic response.
No, it's actually to recondition the brain to overcome specific fears. That means we are tied 1-1, and we have to have a tie breaker.
Oh, my.
Okay.
Sudden death.
Yes.
Suspense.
Okay, so the tiebreaker works like this. I'm going to ask a question that has a numerical answer. Whoever guesses closer to the correct number will get it right. Okay, so it's not multiple choice. According to 2013 data reported by AP, how much water does an American drink on average each year?
Ooh. I'm trying to do a quick calculation in my head. I'll say 80 gallons.
Okay, Casey?
I was also trying to do some quick calculations in my head.
And on your scratch pad.
Basically, what I was thinking is, how big is a gallon of milk? And just imagining that. So I'm going to go with 120.
The correct answer is actually 58 gallons. So, whoop. Leszek, you won by the skin of your teeth.
By the skin of my teeth.
So close.
And congratulations to this week's winner, Alicia Martinez. We'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.